This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. A surprising number of questions for one of today's panel. Chris, can it just be a 50-minute Ellis monologue? Henry, I know this might be a bit of a random one, but does Ellis have any strong opinions on Wales going to the World Cup? Jake, will Ellis be giving his thoughts via text to speak? There's no way he's going to have any voice left. Mike, not sure I'd be more excited for a pod. Will Ellis James be alive and well for it? Let's find out. This is The Guardian Football Weekly. There is a panel today. I'd largely say in supporting roles. Jonathan Wilson, welcome.
Morning, how are you doing?
Very good. Troy Townsend, hello.
Good morning, Max.
Michael says, I would be listening anyway, but I can feel myself getting emotional listening to Ellis already. In the intro, Ellis, I didn't mean to ramp up the pressure on you, but you get a World Cup wall chart with a Welsh flag on it. How does it feel?
I cried during the anthem. I cried during a Mawhid. I cried when the goal went in. And then I cried at the final whistle and I thought I was all cried out. And then I saw Jonathan's wry smile when I logged onto the Zoom and I've started to cry again.
his head is in his hands. Robin says, is this the best moment of Ellis James's life?
I was talking about this. I think it has to be the quarterfinal because... That semi, as I walked to the ground, I remember thinking we are 90 minutes from the final of a major tournament and it was 0-0 at half-time. And there was something about that team, there was something about that summer that I actually thought we were going to do it until I realised after we were playing in the slate grey and lime green top that we'd never won a game in. So clearly the footballing gods had decided that it wasn't going to be our day. But there is something about the World Cup that just is. And it's the one we've come so close to qualifying for so many times, and it was interesting actually because in the last 10 minutes, having been to the Romania game in 1993 and having been to the Russia playoff for Euro 2004 and the Ireland game in 2017, when there's something that you've wanted for so long and the players have worked so hard for and you can feel it slipping away, and it wasn't slipping away, and Ben Davies kept making heroic block after heroic block, and Wayne Hennessy is the Bumaris, Lev Yashin. And, you know, they said there was 5 minutes of extra time. And I thought, of added time, I thought, I think it's going to be fine. And then when the final whistle blew, the relief around the ground, because we didn't qualify for 2016 in this way. We did qualify for 2020 in this way because we beat Hungary 2-0 and Rambo sublime that night. But obviously we'd got to the Euros, the tournament before. So it was a lot of new feelings. As someone who'd imagined it an awful lot for about just over 30 years, things like Dafydd Iwan singing a song in Welsh that's about the survival of the Welsh language, the Welsh nation that he wrote in the wake of Thatcher winning the 83 election. You know, Welsh is spoken, I think at the 2011 census, it was about 20% of the population, but, you know, the figures vary. To hear the whole ground sing that and see Gareth Bale sing it, who's not a Welsh speaker, Ramsey is and Joe Allen is and Ben Davies is, but Bale isn't. And I don't think Conor Roberts is, and he loves that song, and Gunter certainly is, and he loves that song. They were the ones who requested David to sing it prior to the Austria game. To see everyone sing and to hear the whole ground sing it, it just means that it's a cultural moment and not just a sporting moment. So, and I also bumped into a lot of Wales away veterans. I talked to one, Blot Risu, Denmark away in 87 was his first one. I mean, so many failed campaigns. And it's just this huge relief. And I did the Today programme just now and they asked me how I thought we'd get on. And I said, I don't care. that's not the important thing, really. It'll probably be Bale's last hurrah. But again, I mean, I don't know what the panel think of this. He never gives anything away of himself. You don't actually know very much about Gareth Bale. You know that he went to school with Geraint Thomas, the Tour de France winner, and Sam Warburton, the British Lion. He likes playing golf. That's pretty much it. So I don't know what his plans are. I couldn't tell you. But I mean, he'll carry on until November. We can be certain of that. And I read Jonathan's piece, which I thought was tremendous in the paper, about how even now, in the sort of final chapter of his career, he's not the player he was. but he just makes things happen. And we're so lucky to have him. I just can't believe it.
So it's just a 50-minute monologue. This is great. There are two things
No,
it's perfect. One is, when asked, was this the greatest moment of your life? You instantly could only decide between this and another footballing moment. It's clearly nothing to do with kids, you know, getting married, all those things.
Oh, my God.
I like the idea of the...
Please don't do that. Edit that out.
There wasn't even... You didn't even pause for thought. It was like, oh, this was 2016. The other is, I like the idea of the Today programme of saying, I don't care, and, you know, John Humphreys or whatever, having... pressing you and just asking you the same question over and over again.
I would say that the birth of my children stands on a different pedestal to football. I'm going to defend myself.
No, do.
I don't know if you agree with this, Max. When my daughter was born, I have two children, a son and a daughter and a young son. When my daughter was born, firstborn, sort of 7 years ago, I felt elation that it had all gone okay, but then I felt extreme anxiety that I was just going to be the worst dad ever. And I remember the nurse said, you need to put a vest on this baby because it's cold in here. And I couldn't do it. I remember because I thought I was going to rip her head off because this whole front, she'd only been alive 15 seconds. And I couldn't do it. I remember thinking, oh my God, if you can't get the vest right... what chance have you got with puberty and all that stuff?
I think football is a much easier thing to sort of navigate in terms of joy and you know, I think the birth of your child, to be honest, was an out of body experience. And at that stage, I was still thinking, I don't know if I really want this or not.
When
Cambridge United win, like get promoted, or like England get to the final, I know I want that, right? It's an absolute given. It's not like there are no grey areas.
When Aaron Ramsey scored those two goals against Hungary to qualify for 2020, I didn't think, oh God, now I'm going to have to get him through his tricky teenage years. It was just great. We get to go to the Euros again.
Mark says, are the lifelong England fans on the pod today, like me, just a little bit jealous of Wales fans, their noise, their anthem, their passion and their pride on and off the pitch? Troy, are you jealous?
I'm just so glad to have a question. I'd like to be able to answer a question to be totally at this stage, because I was actually enjoying just listening to Ellis and the emotion that he's showing already. Sorry, Max, what was the question again? I can't remember.
Oh, it doesn't look. That's 10 seconds of you. You'll have more time later. Wilson, you were there. The atmosphere. I mean, we'll go back to Ellis for another 15 minutes in a second.
Yeah, can I just come back? I am getting the full fee for this, aren't I?
Yeah. Don't worry.
Yeah, I would say I am jealous of it. It's the thing I often think, as a Sunderland fan, looking at fans of Liverpool or Manchester City or Manchester United, and how they never seem particularly happy. They're always just sort of angry because they expect success. And I sort of I'm not as bothered by England as I am by Sunderland. But I think being a fan of a smaller club or smaller country, you get these moments more rarely, but they're that much more special when they do happen. But the whole occasion yesterday was great. You know, I think last time I was on, I was talking about how sort of I felt quite disillusioned about the whole thing. The Champions League final was an awful experience. Looking ahead to Qatar and you know the nature of that World Cup and talking about having been in Yaoundé, you know, the day after the same disaster and having to sort of go around the hospitals and everything. And so I said, you know, I just wanted to end. But actually, this is what it is about. And there's a great sense of, you know, it wasn't just about Wales, it was also about Ukraine. There's this great sense of mutual respect. And there was that lovely moment at the end when I think probably it happened sort of organically because the Ukraine players had gone to their fans. Then the Wales players went to the Ukraine players, and that meant they were in front of Ukraine fans, and they applauded the Ukraine fans, and that was a great moment. So there was this great sense of positive patriotism on both sides and sort of mutual respect. And the fact that the Wales fans applauded the Ukrainian anthem, the fact that when Daphne Wan was there before kickoff, the Ukraine fans were all holding their flags up at the same time. It was just a great occasion.
Jono says, can Ellis please tell us in punishing detail how much he loves each player in the squad?
Ramsey missed a bit of a sitter right at the start of the second half, and 2-0 would have really settled this. I had my head in my hands, like all football fans do when those chances are missed. And then I thought, Aaron, we've been through too much for me to hold this against you. he's my favourite. But Nico Williams, who is, I think, he's our real next, he's the next real talent. And he had a cracking season at Fulham, because obviously he's a Liverpool player, but he was on loan at Fulham. I thought he was tremendous. I thought Ben Davis was fantastic. Wayne Hennessy, the Beaumaris Levy Ashin, where did that come from? I mean, because Danny Ward is now really our official number one, but Wayne played in the semi-final against Austria, so Rob kept him in. And also, he's immensely experienced. He's got over 100 caps. Wayne, just stop after stop after stop. And you don't often get the feeling that it's your night. When, as Jonathan said, you support, you know, a smaller country. I think the difference between Wales and England is that we have no expectations, which means that it's just a party then. So when you win, it's great. And when you lose, well, it's sort of to be expected. Obviously, you know, we expected to beat Andorra in qualifying for Euro 2016, for instance. But in the main, our expectation levels are very low. So you just enjoy it in a completely different way. I've always wondered what it must be like to be German, to actually expect to win World Cups and European Championships. I mean, it's difficult to fathom. But yeah, that team also, they love it. And the thing with international football, it's a sort of slightly derided form of the game, in that you're told that the players don't take it as seriously and that the players don't care as much. And certainly with this, and I think that's probably true for some Wales players in the past. We've had Wales players who should have been great for every single one of their caps because they weren't Premier League players, retiring early. And you think, I mean, obviously I've never played for Bob Wales, but I haven't retired. They could call me up at any time. But this group of players just absolutely love it. And it's something that's carried on now into the Rob Page era. And our second string, our second 11, played very well against Poland and lucky to lose, I thought, out in Poland in the Nations League on Wednesday night. So you just think that there's the sort of the future's bright, really. I couldn't be happier. I could be more articulate, but I couldn't be happier.
No, that's fine. It's interesting you call it the Rob Page era. Is that how people see it now? Because he's done such a brilliant job.
Yeah, and the players seem to love him. I think obviously it's a very tricky situation. I think Giggs is still in contract until the end of the World Cup, to the end of the World Cup cycle. I think his court case is in August. But I mean, this is Rob Page's team now. You know, he wasn't really setting the managerial world alight prior to managing Wales. But, you know, neither was Gary at Sheffield United before Gary Speed took over. So you can't call it, can you? And, he's great at press and he really gets it. And he's very good at talking about, you know, what it means to the fans and stuff. So, yeah, I'm just delighted with the way it's working out.
Stephen says, better than Ramsey, no club, but train well and no injury to the World Cup, or get a club and be match fit, but receive inevitable metatarsal injury and miss World Cup. What do you think they're both going to do?
I don't know. I mean, Rangers don't want Aaron. Juve don't, so he's looking for a club. Gareth, I mean, who knows? I mean, he is continually linked with Cardiff City. But again, he never says any of this stuff and he doesn't feed it and he doesn't really respond to it. So it's sort of his agent as he's talking for him. You would want them to be playing, but playing a little bit, sort of what he was doing at Madrid is kind of perfect, really. Because, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if it would be horrendous if they got injured and were unable to play. But, he's linked, Gareth in particular is linked with the MLS. People have talked about going back to Tottenham, going to Newcastle. I just don't know. He's earned enough money. If wages are a sticking point, you have to wonder what's going on there, because he's a multi-millionaire. But I don't know, because he keeps his cards so close to his chest. I think what I want is for him to go to a club who see him as a sort of Rolls Royce that they drive every other Sunday, and he might play sort of maybe half an hour a month between now and November.
I mean, I sort of feel bad to ask you this question this morning, but we've talked about it so much, about what do we do? How do we support this World Cup? What are we doing? It almost feels easier for England fans to go, oh, I can sort of dip into this one and out. But you haven't been to a World Cup since 1958.
I discussed this in the pub prior to the game. And I think it's unfair that football supporters are asked to make these moral you know, asked to have these moral discussions and are faced with these moral quandaries. I mean, one of the things actually that settled the nerves in the pub prior to the game was Qatar's so difficult to get to. A lot of the hotels haven't been built, which isn't ideal. I think the upshot of if you decided not to go for ethical reasons is I think watching it in Wales will be just as much fun. It is a shame. You know, I would love this tournament to be Germany in 2024 because that's absolutely perfect. You know, Germany's very accessible and the football culture's great over there. It does taint it, but I think that is an argument for tomorrow rather than an argument for today because I've got a few months to decide how I feel about that, I think. Whereas at the moment, I'm so delighted, I'm so elated that the players have got there on merit that I can't really think objectively about anything else.
How pleased were you when it said check complete when Joe Allen walloped Yarmolenko in the box?
Yeah. What did you think of the refereeing performance yesterday to the panel? Because I thought he was quite card happy, I thought.
Yeah, I must admit, I thought he was almost playing up to the game. Decided that he wanted to be in control. And I get it sometimes, but the enormity of the game, I think he wanted to be the person in control and you know, take away Wales and Ukraine and just have me on the pitch almost. But I find the decision remarkable that is not given as a pen first off and then on the 15 times that they probably watched it on VAR as well. I find it remarkable that we bring in this new video system and it cannot identify that is a pen. It's a foul. It's a foul, blatantly. My heart was in my mouth. I've got no connection to Wales whatsoever. I did search once they qualified yesterday to see if there was just a minute bit that maybe I could be Welsh, but no, it wasn't there. But my heart was in my mouth because it's you know, you've got to praise Yarmolenko for the way that he crept around the back, toe poke the ball, and you know, Allen thinks he's striking the ball out of play or up the field, doesn't he? And he catches him. It's a free kick anywhere else on the field of play. It's not a booking. You say, "I know it was an accident. Never mind. You know, get on with it." But that is a pen. And I don't know what we're doing with this system again.
Because I actually thought that booking for Allen was a yellow card, and then Dan James did run right up to the referee and say, "Fuck off," Dan, in his face, which arguably is a straight red, you know, in Sunday League. But I don't know what you think, Wilson.
Yeah, I mean, Mateo Lajos has got a sort of reputation as being sort of the Spanish Mike Dean. And I think those first two yellow cards, which is what, the second minute, third minute, I thought they were right. But then there was I can't even remember, was a Ukrainian player got booked, I don't know, after about half an hour for basically just sort of an arm in the chest that was just a totally standard kind of, you know, I don't even think it was a foul. Just sort of, you know, two players jostling for the ball.
It's a contact sport, ref. It's a contact sport.
I mean, but did both coaches end up getting booked as well?
Yeah, well, Rob Page.
The Ukrainian got spoken to. I can't remember if he actually got booked or not. So, yeah, it was a very sort of look at me performance. And then, you know, he got the big decision wrong, which, as with John Moss in the playoff final, you could say, well, you know, it's not really his fault. You can understand why he didn't see that. But I just don't understand how VAR is not giving that, because our reaction in the press box as soon as we saw the first replay was, oh dear.
Yeah.
And like, there's nobody thinking, oh, this is 50-50. Everyone's like, oh.
Yeah.
And I admit I was thinking, oh, because I didn't want to have to sit through extra time and penalties and maybe miss my train. and I certainly didn't want to have to queue outside Cardiff Station in the rain, which was torrential all afternoon. But still, I was thinking, And then suddenly it's like, oh, no, he's let him off.
Even you know, when Welsh co-coms are like, yeah, I think they're going to have a look at that. You're like, okay, that's probably a penalty. We should talk about Ukraine because it's sort of extraordinary what they achieved, right? Given that, you know, over half that team hadn't played competitive football apart from the Scotland game since sort of this year. And I don't know if this is nonsense. I tweeted this last night and maybe it is, but I sort of sense the conflict in Ukraine is going down the news cycle. We are less bothered about it today than we were when it on day one of the invasion. And it's no different for the people sort of suffering there. And had they qualified, and we, who knows what the conflict would be like in November, but every time they play it, brings it back to the public consciousness. And I feel desperately for those fans and those players and for the whole country, obviously. But I just think that is something that when the World Cup starts, we won't be thinking about Ukraine and Russia as much as perhaps we would if they were there. Does that make any sense?
I've never watched a football match in that emotional or political context before. It was absolutely extraordinary. And I saw the Zinchenko press conference prior to the Scotland game, where he talked about what it would mean to the Ukrainian people. And he was saying, I've been talking to people at home and they were telling me that they have two dreams. The first dream is that Putin stops bombing us. And the second dream is that we qualify for the World Cup. And, you know, it does put 64 years of hurt and Joe Jordan's handball, all of that kind of stuff, into a completely different context. And I've never watched football in that scenario before. I felt desperately sorry for them. I was looking over at the supporters opposite where I was in the Canton stand. I felt desperately sorry for them. I think the difference is I've read articles in the press asking for you know, Ukraine to be to qualify at our expense, of them to be given a bye. It is ultimately a sporting contest, and those players wouldn't have wanted that. The players wanted to get their own merit. There's a bit in Fever Pitch where Nick Holmby talks about watching Arsenal play during the first war in Iraq, the first Gulf War, and he says he'd never seen, you know, Arsenal play with his country at war before. And it's one of those things where it brings politics crashing into the scenario and into the theatre that where we get most escapism. And you couldn't escape reality last night. I mean, you know, there were lots of Ukrainian flags in the Welsh end and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, it felt bigger than football yesterday.
And actually, Wilson, that's one of the interesting things that I've been doing the radio the last couple of days and talking to sort of Ukrainian football experts, but talking about what this little, even these two games have meant to people who are in bomb shelters at the moment, you know, and you know, Ellis mentioned escapism, and that's sort of, that thing that we're all trying to work out is like what football means and how important it is and whether it means anything or nothing or everything. And I guess, and I think you put something about that in your column as well. It is interesting that even those Ukrainians, you know, who are just under the ground waiting to be bombed are desperately trying to watch this football match.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of means whatever you want it to mean, that it can be an escapism. I think from Ukraine's point of view, just playing, just sort of being there with the flag, with the anthem, is significant. It's saying you are still part of this sort of greater global culture in a way that Russia now isn't. Had they won, had they gone to the World Cup, I mean, you're right to the extent that it would have kept Ukraine forefront of our consciousness. I mean, they are still in the Nations League and they are playing Scotland and Ireland and Armenia, I think, in that. So, you know, as British broadcasters, we're still going to have plenty of opportunities to talk about Ukraine, and we probably should take those opportunities. But realistically, they could win the World Cup, and if Russia conquers Ukraine next January, it doesn't matter at all. So, and it also, yeah, puts Wales in a whole other position, the position of being the bad guys. It isn't their fault at all. So I think you have to sort of, it would have been absurd for Ukraine to be sort of given the pass. And as Ella says, I'm sure they wouldn't have wanted that. Yeah, there's no reason for Wales to be punished for that. But I think that was what was so uplifting about last night, was there was this sort of positive patriotism and there was this mutual respect. And that's as it should be. And I was even willing to forgive the half dozen or maybe a dozen Ukrainian fans who sang drunken folk songs all the way back on the train as I was trying to sleep. And I didn't point out, like, lads, it's a quiet coach.
probably wasn't the moment. Ellis, we have to let you go to the dentist. What a way to celebrate.
Yeah, I've got a scale and polish.
Root canal work, just to make you feel better. You can think of Ben Davis' heroic blocks as the drill goes in. Do you have any final thoughts?
there is a purity to international football that means that when the smaller countries do qualify, it is such a pure, perfect feeling of joy. And I've wanted last night for a very long time, so I'm very glad it's happened. But thank you for having me on the pod. My teeth are going to absolutely sparkle in about 45 minutes' time. Anyway, thank you very much.
See you, mate. Ellis James there, and that'll do for part one. We'll be back trying to sound as engaged as England's pretty average performance away at Hungary as we can do in just a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. The live tour is, 2 weeks away? A week away? I think it's exactly a week today. Yes, it is. Monday, the 13th of June, me, Wilson, Barry, John Bruin are in Leeds. On the 15th, me, Barry, John Bruin and Jordan Jarrett Bryan are in Birmingham. In Manchester, me, Philippe, Barry and AN other, Lars Sivertsen, has pulled out through injury, but it will be a Galactico to replace him. Jonathan Wilson, I believe, is joining us in Dublin. Is this correct, Wilson? Is this confirmed yet?
Nothing is yet confirmed.
But if Lars is out, then hopefully Wilson will be in for Dublin 4th and 5th of July. Troy, you're coming to the Hackney Empire. And so are you, Jonathan Wilson, along with Nikki Bandini and Barry on Friday the 8th of July. Then me, Barry Ellis, Barney Ronnie Sid Lowe on the Saturday. And then the tour finishes on the 13th of July. Me, Barry, Philippe Auclair, and you again, Jonathan Wilson. God, getting booked a lot, Wilson, aren't you? Go to myticket.co.uk. And there are still a tiny number of tickets available, and more of those in Birmingham. It's going to be so echoey in Birmingham. It's going to echo. Anyway, I've got some secret filming to do this week for the live tour, which I'm slightly wary about doing. But anyway, it's all for a good cause. Troy, look, now Ellis has gone. You said in that little break, we haven't actually talked about the game yet. And if we talk a bit more about the Wales game, it means we can talk less about the Hungary England game. So what did you want to say? I mean, Ukraine were good in this game, weren't they?
No, you want to commend the way that Ukraine approached the game, particularly after, you know, I felt Scotland were failed to live up to the kind of enormity of the game the other night. And you could say that was the Scottish not performing or underperforming, but actually it was the way that Ukraine dominated and bossed the midfield and, you know, created opportunities at will. And I felt they had the momentum going into this one. You know, a great win in Scotland. They, you know, shuffle over to Wales. And I was worried for Wales, to be totally honest, because I felt that Ukraine, you know, the bit between their teeth, obviously the enormity of the game, the expectation and the fans as well, who obviously we've given credit for as well. And I thought they started well, but it was good to see Wales creep into the game. Hennessy, who has been obviously not played much football. And, you know, I remember Wayne at Palace and he was vilified quite a lot for his performances at Palace, which ultimately led him to leave, although he, you know, is a Premier League experienced goalkeeper. And he pulled out probably one of his best 90 minutes or 95 minutes of football that he's ever done to secure that victory. But let's not take away the defence who, yes, you know, Hennessy made 9 saves. It's an incredible amount of saves, isn't it? But like you said, Ben Davis at the end there, just putting any part of his limb in the way. You know, Roden, who doesn't get a lot of football, to be totally honest. Ampadu can't make it at Chelsea, and Nico Williams, who's had to go out to Fulham, play well, but, you know, not playing in the Premier League. That's the enormity of what Wales have achieved against a very, very good side. You know, they were dominated for long periods, but they created a lot of opportunities themselves. I don't know what Yarmolenko was doing for the goal. Maybe someone else can explain it to me, because I'm not quite sure. Even in dropping back in, the way that he headed it, I think he felt that he was up the other end and was putting Ukraine 1-0 up. It just didn't seem right to me. But he almost made it up, didn't he, by the pen, or the lack of a pen. But that second half, end-to-end, riveting. And yeah, even my heart was in my mouth right near the end. 5 minutes seemed far too long for me, and I felt that there was going to be some, you know, deflection that was going to take the ball into the back of the net. But up popped again Wayne Hennessy. Great save with about 10 minutes to go, although just after the Welsh had hit the post, Johnson had hit the post, didn't he? And then there was another chance. Bow forced a great save. But it, listen, it was a great game for a neutral as well. And yeah, it was just a really good all-round football match that, you know, one team gets the glory and unfortunately the other one doesn't.
I think you've summed it up very well, Troy. I mean, it was a brilliant football match. There was so much. I mean, sometimes with football matches, the context is sort of more than the actual kicking of the ball, Wilson. But it was a really entertaining game. And I suppose when there's so much riding on it, perhaps you watch it differently. I don't know. But it felt like a brilliant football match as well.
Yeah, I think it was a great game. I really enjoyed it. It was my last game of the season. And
what it was all about, obviously.
Yeah, but it was a really good way to finish.
That folk song is about Jonathan Wilson. Yeah. I think that's what it is, isn't it?
But yeah, a great atmosphere, great occasion, great football, great drama, great tension. I mean, you sort of felt the last sort of 10 minutes that Ukraine weren't going to get the equaliser, just because they'd had so many opportunities and hadn't. But yeah, the ball was in the box a lot in the last, I mean, yeah, the 5 minutes of added time. And yeah, conditions, I don't know how obvious it was on telly, but conditions were pretty difficult. And that was the other thing with Hennessy, you know, his handling in very, very wet conditions. And there was a handful of those sort of long-range shots sort of skidded and he got behind and held onto them. So it wasn't just the saves he made, he sort of projected this confidence. And then that began really early. So yeah, I thought it was a really enjoyable game, and I mean, yeah, Ben Davis was excellent for Wales. Nico Williams was excellent. The player who struggled was Aaron Ramsey, and you do wonder if he doesn't get more regular football, or you do wonder where he'll get more regular football. You know, if he's not good enough to play that regularly for Rangers, then where can afford him that will give him regular football leading into the World Cup? And obviously, you know, his last one of his last acts in a Rangers shirt was missing the penalty in the Europa League final.
Here to watch us, does the fact English players are having to play in pointless international matches during their only break from football mean we'll still be able to claim they're tired after our exit from the Winter World Cup? It wasn't a fascinating game. Look, some people have said, look, this is clearly important for Gareth Southgate, right? He's only got 5 games before the World Cup. Those games then matter. But I really struggled to get engaged and energised about this game, Troy.
That's because there was nothing to get engaged or energised about. From the whistle, first minute. The Nations League, when it gets to the latter stages and, you know, you get to the top teams from the top groups and you think to yourself, yeah, this tournament means something because there's still a trophy at the end of it. But they're still glorified friendlies to me. They're still, I don't know, not approached in the same way. And having 4 games at the end of a long season after not a long break the season before, you've got to wonder, I don't know. I know that the diary's packed and I know it's difficult, but it's almost like England accepted the defeat without accepting the defeat, by the way. I might be controversial here. I think the pen's a pen. Hungary thoroughly deserved the win, as far as I'm concerned. I thought England lacked in so many different areas that could be quite worrying. But then I also think that they'll get up for the game against Germany and they'll produce a performance that will make everyone forget about the Hungary game. But there was so much not to like about the performance, which might leave Gareth worried. But the best thing he can do or they can do is put in a performance against Germany that would make us all forget it.
I mean, I guess the point is Nations League is better than friendlies, but it still doesn't really matter, right? So it's...
Is it?
I think it is, because you do play teams of, you know, it's been great for, you know, group D or whatever, for smaller nations to play competitive games against each other. I think it definitely, well, I think it is. I mean, you know, I can't speak for the whole of football, but...
I think it is, but I think I saw we got some criticism after the last podcast for being sort of negative about international football. But it's not been negative about international football, it's about being negative about this batch of games, because it feels such a bolt-on to kind of a season that's already been exhausting. And you know, if we as journalists and fans feel this exhausted, how do players feel? And you could see even Southgate's selection, that wasn't a first-choice England team. That was and he himself said it. It was a half an England team plus a few he was trying out. And you know, he was giving players, and probably more players than he'd like to, get, you know, having a look at them. And by definition, if you're doing that, you're not taking it with 100% seriousness. So I sort of feel that the Nations League was great when it came in. That first year was great. I wonder if you've spoiled it slightly by making it groups of four, not three, that adds an extra fixture, well, extra two fixtures. I mean, I presume he'll try and avoid getting relegated, but if England do lose every game to Italy and Germany and Hungary, yeah, so what, really? I mean, they're good sides. If we're not putting out a first team, well, so be it.
There's a quirk of international football, and James Justin is a great example of this, where someone who's clearly a very good footballer, who's actually been played out of position and plays 45 minutes, and people say, can he do the step up, when most games he's playing are harder than playing Hungary, but they sort of decide the fate of international footballers on that, which I always find so infuriating that decisions are made like that. I mean, clearly Gareth Southgate is smarter than that, but he was sort of quite open about Justin struggling for that 45 minutes. I know he was carrying an injury, and Jared Bowen played okay, didn't he? Troy, we do have to talk about UEFA's Article 73. I wonder if it was worth writing 73 articles if the 73rd one is children aged 14 and under are allowed to go to games behind closed doors if accompanied by an adult. It is worth pointing out that England are using this loophole as well at Molineux for the game there after the stadium ban, after what happened in the final of Euro 2020, which is a different reason for a ban, but it's still a stadium ban. I spoke to Henry Winter yesterday. He said, look, the jeers when England took the knee were noticeable, you know, it wasn't like a cacophony, but it was noticeable, and that is mainly 14-year-olds and under doing it, which is pretty depressing.
The reason why UEFA gave Hungary games behind closed doors, one of which is suspended, by the way, was because their fans monkey charted at England's black players. So let's put it into perspective. They monkey charted at England's black players on more than one occasion. They've done it before. They've done it again. They've crossed the line quite a number of times. And the best thing that UEFA can come up with is a new article that's only been in for a couple of seasons now to allow fans to still attend their games. Now, those fans, young, old, whatever they may be, will know about the last game against England in Hungary. Well, absolutely. If they weren't in the stadium, they would have been watching it on the TV. They have a privilege to go to a football match because their older fans as such have been racially abusing England's black players. What does anyone expect is going to happen at a moment when England are just about to take the knee? I don't know. You know what? And this actually is not about the fans. This is more about UEFA and their ripping up of a zero tolerance rule. And then deciding that actually they're going to expose the players to a little bit more. Now, booing is not the worst thing you could ever do in the world, but it's the act of what they're booing at. Everyone knows why. Let's compare it to Wales versus Ukraine. Jonathan, you was in the stadium. It seemed to me, from where I was watching the game from, that there was a real mutual respect as 22 players and maybe some on the bench as well took the knee from the stadium. Which kept in keeping with the way that game was gonna play out, and the way that mutual respect continued right at the end with the Welsh in front of the Ukraine fans and everything else. Someone needs to get a grip here, whether it's FIFA, whether it's UEFA, I don't know, because to be honest, Max, I'm tired of continually talking about situations that actually develop even more because of a governing body. And that's what we're in. That's the state we're in now. They develop even more because a governing body decides to amend or put in an article that allows that kind of thing that happened on Saturday afternoon to happen again.
I mean, it's learnt behaviour, isn't it, from teenagers who do it. And actually, you kind of think the way that would work out is like, oh, look, we can go to this game because they probably, lots of those children wouldn't have been able to go to the game. So like, oh, how come we get to go to this game, mum or dad? Oh, because the fans were racist. It's actually probably better if they go, how come we can't go to this game, right? How come this game is behind closed doors? Those are conversations that would begin if all those kids are watching that game on the TV and they're saying, why is there no one there?
I don't know if you saw the comment from the Secretary of State of Hungary. Let me read it out. Anyone who thinks that children attending a football match in Budapest can be blamed for any kind of political statement is truly an idiot. Congratulations to our national team. applause for the 35,000 kids. And then in his, this is a tweet, by the way, decided to at a number of prominent UK journalists. And for me, that's almost the two fingers required from them to say, UEFA has allowed us to do it. The fans have the opportunity to boo if they want to boo, because you over there in England have made this taking of the knee political. And yet everything, every message that has come out of the England changing room, who have been more proactive than most, is about raising awareness, is about the fact that their black players continually are subjected to that kind of abuse. And, you know, they've distanced themselves from anything that anyone wants to say that Black Lives Matter, taking a knee, is a political movement within our sport, within our sport. But the ignorance around this all, you know, let's be serious. The ignorance has developed over many, many years. This is not about Black Lives Matter. This is actually almost not about taking a knee. This is about the way that, if we're talking about international football, our English players of colour have been exposed time and time again, and nothing has happened to protect those players on the field of play. I'll mention it again. They're going out to work. You know, they're the entertainers. They're doing their thing on the field of play, and they continually get punished for that.
What I wonder, Jonathan, about sort of UEFA, you know, it's sort of when we criticise governing bodies and we criticise everybody, you can't imagine that everybody that goes into work at UEFA or goes into work at FIFA, you know, is blind to what is happening. And there are people who are trying to change it for good from within. And they must find it sort of infuriating that these decisions are made as well to sort of bend the rules to allow people in. I mean, it's hard when you see like kids enjoying a football match, your instant reaction is to go, oh, that's nice. I don't know. I don't know if there's a question there. I sometimes think, you know, do we need to be smarter about our criticism of governing bodies as to exactly who is making those decisions and why they're making those decisions?
Yeah, I mean, you can see how this article was added, that they sort of thinking, well, yeah, is there any way we can turn this kind of negative into a positive, and oh, maybe we can get kids to go and watch? And you can sort of see how, at a very superficial level, you might think that's quite a nice idea. We saw this after Slavia Prague got the ban after the abuse of Glenn Kamara, and exactly the same thing happened. So we already know that this doesn't work. So yeah, I think he's got to remove that article immediately, because we know it fails. And then if your question is actually how can we get more kids watching football live, you've got to look at other things such as ticket prices and you know, whether you can give cheaper tickets to schools or whatever. But they seem to have sort of shoved two issues together that it's just, you know, created an additional problem. But I mean, in terms of UEFA, and I mean, yeah, I'm sure there are good people at UEFA, but if this is a body that can't run the final of their own tournament that they've been doing for 70-odd years, 60-odd years, that's a much easier thing than this. And at the minute, they're just totally sclerotic and unable to function.
You have to think about the mindset of a group of people that come to that. So we're saying, you know, there must be good people at UEFA. Well, they're good people, but with not enough power to override decisions that are being made. Yeah. And you have to think about the mindset that you would change the article, all right, to get young people in. As Jonathan says there, it didn't work. The Rangers players were booed much more than the England players, by the way. And every time a Rangers black player got on the ball, it increased. So you know that's what you are setting those players up to receive. So cross the article out and make it no more, and make behind closed doors be behind closed doors.
I don't know. I'm not trying to give UEFA a pass. I'm just trying to think, how do we get the conversation to go further than just every time this happens, we just go, well, look, they're a bunch of idiots, etc. Do you know what I mean? They're just sort of, and maybe they are, but you just sort of think there must be people who love football who are involved in these, you know, there must be football fans who are involved in these organisations. And when you get to the top of FIFA, I suppose it's another question, isn't it? I mean, I would love somebody who ran a governing body to not want to be there to hand the trophy out, to go, look, that's nothing to do with me. I'm going to be in a back room. I'm just trying to make football good for football fans. You know, I occasionally daydream about running football. I might be shit, but at least I'd have like the right intentions, you know? Anyway, on a less important note, great news for ITV that Channel 4 now have a 0% win record covering England. Mark Pugach swinging his shirt around his head, going, come on, we're in second position now. Although, look, we did beat Germany, didn't we, on ITV? So, and maybe Denmark as well, I can't remember. Anyway, there were some other Nations League games. There'll be some more this week.
Well, no, the two interesting ones were Austria beating Croatia 3-0 and the Dutch beating the Belgians 4-1, I think it was in the end. So it turns out that maybe Ralf Rangnick and Louis van Gaal, maybe the problems were actually Manchester United and not them.
It's possible.
That Belgian defence with two 40-year-olds and Dedric Boyata.
I love that Belgian defence. It's going to be like that forever. Vertonghen and Alderweireld was there and one other. Yes, Troy?
And didn't De Bruyne tell us that actually, you know, he wasn't interested in that game, full stop. So the result really doesn't come as a surprise. But yeah, two 40-year-olds in defence, I do like that. Legends of the game. That will remain legends forever, I think.
And keep playing forever. Who's gonna retire first, Broad and Anderson or Alderweireld and Vertonghen? It's hard to know, isn't it?
Well, it's very clear who's playing better at the moment.
That is true. It'd be interesting, though, if they would play better playing centre-back for Belgium, actually. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. We're recording a special episode of Football Weekly featuring the experiences from our LGBTQ plus listeners. If you are one of those, we want to hear about what football is like for you at the game, watching in pubs, travelling to and from matches, playing football. Very similar to the pod we did about the experience of women at football. They can be negative, positive. They might have changed over the years. What we want is exactly what you experience. It makes the pod much better. We'll be releasing it during the month of Pride in the UK, which is this month, which is June. There'll be a link in the description of this episode. I'll tweet the link out as well. But we've had lots of response to this so far. We'd love to get more. So yeah, do get in touch. Well done to Grimsby Town back in the Football League following one season in the National League. They needed extra time in all three of their playoff matches. And the way the playoffs are done in the National League, you know, if you come wherever it's 7th or 8th, whatever, you have to play three times to get there. So they did it the hard way. And a wonderful win for them against Solihull. Malcolm says, hi guys, I love the pod. I never miss an episode. As a lifelong, over 50 years Forest supporter, waiting along 23 years, I was, shall we say, a little irked that your main concern post-promotion was seating arrangements and sandwiches. Come on, all of you, you're better than that. We've been down with the dead persons for a quarter of a century. Please make allowances for that. Perhaps we should bring in former player Roy Keane as our food consultant. All the very best. I look forward to hearing about us on the pod from August onwards. Much love. Best regards to all of you. Brighten my week. Every week. Wilson, will you apologise?
Will they apologise? I mean, they're the ones giving me the sandwiches.
That's a very good point. We will, of course, cover Nottingham Forest in all their glory when the Premier League season begins in August. Wilson, what's happening with Lewandowski? Year left on his contract, wants to leave Bayern, won't let him. What's going to happen?
I mean, Bayern seem pretty militant about forcing him to play out the final year of his contract. I mean, Uli Hoeneß, who's now, I think he's just honorary president, but still likes to stick his oar in. He was saying, well, we've seen this before with Lewandowski in his final year at Dortmund. He scored 20 goals. He's an uber professional. Why would it be any different now? We don't need to sell him. Which just seems to me totally the wrong approach, that you're sort of punishing a player for his professionalism, for not throwing his toys at the pram and going on strike or whatever. Lewandowski, I think personally, feels pretty hurt by Bayern's conduct. That he came out after the final game of the season and said, they haven't offered me an extension on the contract. They're also negotiating with Haaland and seemed oddly confident they're going to get Haaland. And now, obviously, they're going after Sadio Mane as well. And he was saying, well, they didn't tell me any of that. And at this age, I need to be kept in the loop as to what my role at the club's going to be. And you think that after he's been there since 2014, he probably does deserve at least to be a clear picture of what his future is. Hasan Salihamidžić, the sporting director, who has a tendency to be clumsy in these matters, sort of said, no, he did have a concrete offer. It's just his agent, sort of, which has been his Harvey, stirring things up, and that's not right. So the phrase that was used by somebody pretty close, Lewandowski, to me was, they haven't lost the player, they've lost the man. So he's desperate to get out, and he feels he's been pretty badly dealt with, which is exactly what happened to Bayern with David Alaba and Niklas Süle as well. So it's a ongoing Bayern issue that I guess they've been so dominant in Germany for so long, both in terms of winning the league and financially, that they are able to be a bit less amenable to player wishes than other clubs.
Troy, how's Andros getting on?
He's away at the moment. So I think he's back. Yeah, he's back this week. He's obviously now on the process of recuperation. So he doesn't get much time off, and I don't think he'd want it. He needs to get back and make the knee stronger and, see where the season will take him. But it definitely won't be the first half, I would imagine.
Right. And psychologically, I mean, it's incredible when you think about how short a career is and you know, to be out for such a long time. And a lot of footballers experience it. And I think fans, we just sort of go, oh, they're doing rehab, without really thinking what that entails and quite how tedious it is and how hard it is.
Yeah, I mean, he's always said that he's never been a good patient and, you know, he just wants to get back out on the field of play. And I think the reality, obviously, of this injury is that getting back out on the field of play is going to be a long, long time away. And mentally, that takes a massive strain on you when you have been active so much. And it's another part of, I suppose, being a professional footballer that you have to try and balance as much as you can. I've always said that he's a bit fortunate, but he's got a young family, and he's always said now, since the children have come, that, you know, they've kind of taken away a lot of the stress and the strain of the game, because they bring reality straight back, you know. They bring reality when you come home, and, you know, his family are going to be massively important in the way that he, you know, deals with the nature of the injury and hopefully comes back, you know, whether it's the end of the year or beginning of the new year.
So it's actually the same with the birth of Ian Rush, then, that my perspective on the pod has completely changed. It used to keep me awake at night, and now I understand that, you know, life has more meaning than just four people on a Zoom call just talking nonsense and hopefully entertaining some people. Andrew says, if the Authors cricket team is coming to our village for a match next Sunday, captained by Football Weekly legend Jonathan Wilson, do the panel have any advice for this lifelong Sunderland supporter to help minimise fanboy behaviour? Also, Max, we need an umpire. Are you busy? I'm not. You know, the key with village cricket is, as soon as the openers go out to bat, you go for a long wee, because you just don't. Anyone do the first 10 overs? Oh, no, I just wasn't around. And then hopefully you're in by then. Andrew is going to be a fanboy, Wilson. Do you appreciate that? Do you want him to bring books to sign, or should he just keep his distance?
No. I'm intending to do very little. My style of captaincy is not to bowl into bat 11, because it just makes things much less complicated. But I've got to give some kind of talk at the change of innings. So, you know, sneak preview, if anybody wants it, I will be talking about selective breeding in Argentinian cattle in the late 19th century. So something to look forward to. And football, like how the two relate to each other.
Right, that's just what you want. All you want in between innings is a Kipling's fondant fancy and a cup of tea, isn't it? And just one sort of egg and cress sandwich turned up at the end that was made about 3 weeks ago.
But it can't go as badly as my first match of the season, which was Saturday, where the good news is I scored 28% of our team's runs. The bad news is we lost by 10 wickets and they had 34 overs to spare.
Onwards and upwards, Wilson.
You'd hope so.
Yeah, that'll do for today. Thank you to Ellis, who's currently at the dentist. Thank you, Troy. Thank you, mate.
Thank you. Pleasure, Max.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
We'll be back on Wednesday after the England-Germany game. Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.